So I'm going to talk about so-called domain of dependence property and some applications to nonlinear wave equations. And I'll try in particular to explain the link with the equations of general relativity. So I guess 340 years ago, a person from Cambridge made this astonishing observation that the equations of physics are mainly differential equations. So, okay, now the Newton's law has been replaced by this simple ODE has been replaced by systems of PDEs of increasing complexity. And this domain of dependence property has to do with these systems of PDEs. Okay, so PDE is a very, very vast subject, so you should not expect to have any statement which holds for any types of PDEs. And here I'm going to be interested in certain types of PDEs. So first I want to consider PDEs which arise from a physical situation where you have dynamics. So I'm not going to be interested in, let's say, systems such as equations arising from electrostatic or magnetostatic physical systems, or I don't know, looking at the time-independent Schrödinger equation. This I don't want to study. I want to study dynamics. So let me start with a couple of examples. So the toy model for that talk is going to be the equation box of u equals 0, where box is an operator, simply defined to be the second derivative with respect to time, minus this, plus, let's say, the sum of the second derivative with respect to space. So that's also called the Laplacian, and I use the notation triangle. Okay? So this on u Minkowski space, so on R4 if you want. All right, so this will be my toy model, and I'll try to generalize a couple of things starting from that equation. So I want to talk about a couple of other equations. So let me also write down the Schrödinger equation. It's this equation. So this is also an equation which represents the evolution of some physical object. But I want to mention that there are also systems for which the domain of dependence property is going to hold. So later I will show that the domain of dependence property does not hold for this equation. Okay? But there are other systems for which the domain of dependence property is going to hold. In particular, let me mention that this thing also holds for the equations arising from the theory of acoustics, which is a study of the propagation of sound waves, that you can also look at this domain of dependence property, let's say, for nonlinear elasticity, but also for the Einstein equations. Okay. So the two equations which I want to study in a bit more detail are the wave equation and the Schrödinger equation. And I want to start with these two equations and explain to you why this domain of dependence property, what it is, and why it holds in that case, and why it doesn't hold in the second case. Okay? So maybe I should. So here I'm going to have box of u equals 0. And here I'm going to have the Schrödinger equation. So these two equations are evolution equations which represent the evolution of certain systems. So when you have an evolution process, if you want to fix a solution, you need to fix some initial data. So let's imagine that this is a t equals 0 surface in some space, okay, where I'm going to fix some initial data. So I'm going to assume that I know what is u at time t equals 0, and what is d by dt of u at time t equals 0. So the Schrödinger equation only depends on the first time derivative of u, so I only need to know u at time t equals 0. Okay, and to make it very simple, I'm going to assume that, because this is an accessible talk, so I have one time dimension and one space dimension only. Okay, to make it simple. And the question which I want to answer, and the question that this domain of dependence property is going to answer, is how fast can information travel from the initial data? Another way of phrasing that is, imagine I have a point here, tx. I'm looking at the solution of this equation at this point, so u of tx. And I want to answer the following question. In order to tell you what is u at tx, do I need to know the whole information about u at time t equals 0 on the whole set of initial data? Or is it sufficient to know what is u, let's say, in the bounded domain here on t equals 0? Well, the answer is that I actually need to know what's happening in the so-called past null cone of the point tx. So in one dimension, if you use the speed of light equal to 1, the path null cone is very simple to draw. It's just you draw the lines at 45 degrees and 135 degrees from starting on tx, and you look at the interior of that triangle, and this is what I will denote by the path null cone of tx. Okay? And the claim is that if you want to know what is u at that point, you only need to know what's happening in this path null cone. So in particular, the information that you need to know about the initial data is what's here. Here, you can take u to be whatever you want. It's not going to influence what's happening on that point. Okay? There is no such analog in the Schrödinger case. Okay, so why is it so? Well, one thing that you could do if you wanted to look at that question, you could use the linearity of the equation and write them using Fourier decomposition. So let's do this very naively. And let's look at the Fourier mode. Okay. Take the ansatz exponential I omega t minus kx. I plug this into the equations. Partial derivatives are going to be the exponential. Factors of omega and factors of k are going to come out. And I'm going to get a relation, asking this to be 0. I'm going to get a relation between omega and k, which is called the dispersive relation. So if I do that, let's say, for the wave equation, I will get, in particular, that the speed of propagation, the ratio between omega and k, is equal to 1, but what interests me is that, in particular, this thing is finite. And here, I will say that I have a finite speed of propagation. I can try to do the same with the Schrödinger equation. Well, if I do so, then I find that the speed of propagation is proportional to the wave number. So if I have the superposition of Fourier modes with infinitely many modes and with modes of higher and higher frequency, then this thing can be as large as it wants. And so these things can be infinite. And this is why here you have infinite speed of propagation. So this makes a very big distinction between the two simple equations. Here, you can't localize things. If you have something which is local in time, you can't localize it in space. Here, if I'm local in time, then I'm completely local in space. Okay? It's also an extremely important physical phenomenon. It means that this equation, if you want, respects causality, because you know there's nothing which can travel faster than light in this picture. All right. So I've been able to derive this domain of dependence property. So the domain of dependence of this point tx is this path null cone. Okay? But for doing that, I have been using this Fourier decomposition. So it's actually a very bad way of looking at it. And the reason is because Fourier decomposition uses extremely the linearity of these equations. But I would like, for instance, to do that for the Einstein equations. And if you're familiar with the Einstein equations, you will know that they are extremely nonlinear. So typically, this type of method fail. So you have to find a different techniques if you want to understand domain of dependence property. And this, you need to use, for this, you need to use the geometry of the equation and the geometry of the underlying space. So I'm not going to get into any details, but I perhaps can give you a flavor of what's happening. So let's erase the Schrödinger equation because it has infinite speed of propagation. Okay, the idea is the following. I'm going to define, so I imagine that I have the equation on the left, and that u is a solution. And I want to define a quantity which I'm going to denote by flux of u. So let's denote that set here, S, capital S. So it's a set which is here. Okay, just the intersection of the path null cone with the initial data t equals 0 surface. So the flux of u on S is simply going to be the integral of S of the first derivative of u squared. So you should think of that as the amount of energy which is entering that triangle. Okay? So it's an ingoing flux. So I'm going also to call that the ingoing flux. You can also define what will be an outgoing flux in terms of coordinates. This outgoing flux will be written as the integral of the null derivative squared along the boundary of the cone. Okay, so you define this outgoing flux, and you can relate this outgoing flux as an ingoing flux using the equation of motion and using essentially Stokes' theorems, and you can prove that this ingoing flux is equal to this outgoing flux. So essentially, this is application of Stokes' theorem. And this is where the geometry comes in, because Stokes' theorem relates the divergence of a vector. So that's where you get tensor analysis, and so you get geometry. All right. So why does it help me for the domain of dependence property? Well, domain of dependence property, you can phrase it also in the following way. If I have two solutions which agree there, then they have to agree everywhere in that triangle. That's all around, says exactly the same. So imagine I have two solutions. I take the difference of these two solutions, and I want to prove that, well, you know, if I have data here which are zero, I want to prove that these things here is zero as well. U is zero here. But that's obvious from that picture, because if the outgoing flux is zero, which amounts to say the same, then if the ingoing flux is zero, then the outgoing flux is zero. And then you can really see, prove that, you know, because these things is positive definite, then the U has to be zero everywhere in that triangle. Okay, so this is how you would prove that in a more robust way. Well, why do I think it is more robust? Because this, you can perturb this analysis if you perturb the equation. So let's imagine now that I have a nonlinear equation. I want to do more or less the same. So I can imagine, for instance, that my equation looks like that. Box of u equals some kind of function, relatively regular, depending on u, depending on t, depending on x, but also depending on the derivative of u. Okay, and to be perfectly honest, if you wanted that to be a toy model for the Einstein equation, you should also perturb that box, and it should be some kind of dependency in u. Okay, so in particular, the Einstein equations can be written in the systems of these things where you replace u by the metric components. All right, so let's make it simple and remove that u. Okay, so I'm not going to do the proof. I'm going to tell you what will be the result. You could prove a very similar type of things. You could prove that the ingoing flux control the outgoing flux, but there will be a loss, so you will get only an inequality. You have to add a constant here. But the conclusion should be the same. If this ingoing flux is zero, then the outgoing flux is zero, and then the solution has to be zero here. Okay? So it reproves the domain of dependence property for quasi-linear equations of that type. And in particular, you could prove it in a similar way for the Einstein equations. Okay. So I've been looking at this domain of dependence property from the point Tx, domain of dependence in that thing. Now I want to look at the reverse picture. So I want to look at... I want to now, if you reverse the picture, you could say that this triangle here is completely determined by data on that set S. Okay, so I'm going to define the so-called domain of determinacy of S. So I will define... let's say d plus of s, so it's a future domain of determinacy of s. Okay, so what is it? Well, it's a set of points which are completely determined by this data on s. So any point in that data triangle is completely determined by this set s, because you go here, you take its path null code, and you see that it completely intersects this thing. So in Lorentzian geometry, there will be a much better way of defining this domain of determinacy of S. It will simply be, it's a set of points where if you take any path causal curve, it has to intersect S once. Okay? So in particular, these points are not in the domain of determinacy of S, because if you take its path null code, you see that it requires more information from the outside of S. Okay? And if you take, let's say, this set here, so if you take this set, smaller set than S, then its domain of determinacy is smaller as well, right? To give you an idea of how you construct it. Okay, so I've defined this D plus of S. I can also define D minus of S, which is a past domain of determinacy of S. So that will correspond to a past triangle like that. All right. So why do I want to do that? I want to do that because I want to perturb a little bit my problem and to look at a slightly more general case. So I was interested originally by the problem, which was box of u equals 0 on R2, if you want, with data, with initial data, on t equals u. Well, this thing is nice, but there is a problem, which is that imagine I want to apply that to general relativity. Well, general relativity, there is no such thing as a t equals 0 surface because you don't have really a preferred time. All right? So I would like to find an analog of this t equals 0 initial data surface. I would like to change that something a bit more general. Well, I know what it has to be. If I want these equations to be perfectly solvable, that is to say, if I want to have this domain of dependence property everywhere, or in other words, if I want to be able to predict what's happening for u in terms of the initial data, I need, if I replace this t equals 0 by, let's say, a surface S, I need that any point lies either in the future domain of determinacy of S or in the past domain of determinacy of S. All right? Because if you have a point which lies outside, then it's not going to be determined by data on S. So in other words, if I replace the t equals 0 by S, and if I ask that d plus of S union d minus of S is equal to R2, this problem still looks very nice. Well, you will actually need a bit more constraint on S because you will also need the fact that, let's say, S is space-like and achronal from Lorentzian geometry, but let me not enter too many details. Okay. Well, this is nice, and so you should think of this constraint, the constraint on the geometry of S and on the geometry of R2. It's a bit similar to asking, I don't know, that S is convex or something like that. It's a constraint on the geometry. But imagine now that I would like to move to something a bit more general. So I would like to do it, let's say, for Lorentzian manifold. So let's start to do it for something even simpler than Lorentzian manifold. Let's say you want to do it for a domain in U in R2. Okay? So now I want to solve the box of U on the domain in R2, not the whole domain. And I ask, okay, what type of U, what are the constraints of U, and what are the constraints on S so that these things, again, is well posed, so you have a unique solution and things are working nicely. Well, I know what it is. I just have to replace that inequality by something like that. I want u to be including in the future domain of determinacy of S and the past domain of S. Okay? That's pretty simple. Okay, now I can try to go even in some more general case. So I could look at a Lorentzian manifold. So before I move to Lorentzian manifold, I'd like to say that if you have a U which satisfies, so U is a domain in R2, and show that there exists a S with this property, I will say that U is globally hyperbolic. U is globally hyperbolic means that I can find a surface, I can find a hypersurface in U, so that if I give data on this hypersurface, the wave equation is well posed. Okay, so in a certain sense, it means that from the point of view of the wave equations, you have can make predictions in that U. And if U was not globally hyperbolic, you wouldn't be able to make any predictions. For instance, if you were to consider a domain in R2, which looked like that. Okay, imagine you just want to solve the wave equation in that domain. Well, you might think, I need to find a new surface, so let's take this as a surface. But the problem is that the domain of determinacy of that surface is simply this diamond here. And points which are here are not determined by data on S. Okay, so you cannot predict anything. So this U here is not globally hyperbolic. And so what I want to try to explain to you is that this notion of global hyperbolicity, the origin of the word comes from the fact that these equations are hyperbolic, So locally, you always have no problem. And it's only when you look at a global picture like that that you realize that you've got some problems with determinism of the theory. So what I want to explain is that this global hyperbolicity is a necessary condition to get prediction in a space-time. Okay? So now what I'm going to say that I'm going to make two claims. The first claim is that let's now try to solve box of U equals 0, but not on R2, but on the Lorentzian manifold. Okay? So M is a manifold, G is a Lorentzian metric, and this box now is a box associated with the metric J. Well, the claim is that if you want these things to be well posed, you need data given on S, where S is a hypersurface in M, and such that D plus of S, so you can define an analog of this domain of determinacy for Lorentzian manifolds, and you want this to be equal to M. Okay? That's the claim. All right, so let me conclude now with the Einstein equations. So the Einstein equations, I told you, they look also like waves. Wave equations, but they are fully nonlinear, so I want to move to the Einstein equations. Okay, so they are fully nonlinear, and what you're solving is you're not only solving for a function, you're solving for the whole space. So you should think that, well, let's try to do two pictures. This was T equals 0 surface in, let's say, R2, and you know, the space was already there, and I was finding the solution a bit everywhere in that space. Well, now it's going to be different, because I've got no underlying space, right? I'm going to start with some data. So data for the Cauchy problem in general relativity, for the initial value problem, is given by a manifold itself, a metric on that manifold. And remember that the Einstein equation, they are second order equation, and if you remember the wave equation, I need u at time t equals 0, and I need the first derivative of u at time t equals 0. So here it's the same. You should think of this h as u at time t equals 0, and I also need some object which corresponds to the second fundamental form and which represents this variation of u. Okay, so that's this initial data. Okay, and I'm trying to solve the Einstein equation, so let me write them down. So I'm going to write them in the vacuum for simplicity. Okay. So here, big R is a Ricci. You should think of that as an operator. If you've never seen that before, you should think of that as a second order operator, which is hyperbolic in some sense. Okay. So it's a generalization of the box operator. And okay, I want to solve these equations, but I've got no underlying space, so that's a problem. And the claim which I want to do is that, you know, here, I needed, if you want M to be globally hyperbolic, that is to say, I needed the existence of a surface S so that these things was old. So here, the claim is that if you solve the Einstein equations, well, the biggest space that you can find is a globally hyperbolic space-time. Because if you want to go further, then the wave equations are going to be unsolvable, in a sense, from the point of view of the Cauchy problem. So in other words, you look at this equation, you look at initial data. So initial data can be a bit arbitrary. But the biggest thing that you can object, that you can find, sorry, is an MJ, which is globally hyperbolic. So I start from my data, and I construct an object which satisfies certain wave equations. And this thing is globally hyperbolic. Well, however, that does not mean that this is the biggest object which can include this data. There might be a bigger object, let's call that M prime, okay, which also contains this data. But that bigger object is not going to be globally hyperbolic. That's what this theorem, the theorem of Madame Choquet-Bruyat and Guérot, which prove that thing. Okay, so unfortunately, if you can embed this initial data and this M in a bigger one, that's very bad from the point of view of physics, because you know everything here has nothing to do, if you want, to the initial data. And so it's a fundamental conjecture in relativity, so-called strong cosmic censorship conjecture. That even though there exists initial data, okay, which leads to a space-time, of course, globally hyperbolic MG, but which can be embedded in the bigger one, even though this exists, this should not happen in general. So if you look at generic initial data, this behavior should disappear. And I think I'll stop here. Well, what the theorem said is that if you start from this initial data, there always exists a unique space-time, okay, which is called MG, which is globally hyperbolic, and which is unique in the sense that any other one, which is also globally hyperbolic, has to be smaller than this one. Okay.
But it doesn't tell that the only solution is the one that is globally hyperbolic.
No, of course not.
If you find the M prime.
Exactly, you can sometimes find the M primes. But you cannot find the n primes by solving the Cauchy problem,
okay.
By solving the initial value problem. That's what this theorem tells you.
Okay.
Okay?
So it's easy to see directly how this links into the way the cosmic censorship thing is usually stated in kind of basic GR courses, which says you don't get any singularity developing from generic initial data.
So, yes and no. You see, the first thing is that if you look at cosmic censorship, there is two different cosmic censorship. You have the weak cosmic censorship and the strong cosmic censorship. And okay, originally it was believed that the strong implies the weak, but with the modern formulation, they are completely independent. Okay, so the weak cosmic censorship will tell you that if you have naked singularities, they have to be hidden in a black hole. But the strong cosmic censorship has nothing to do with that. Okay, so it's independent of that picture. But you could think that naked singularities from the point of view of strong cosmic censorship would be that this is a bigger space-time which you can build up from the initial data. Okay? Now, if you have an observer which moves in that direction, well, this curve is going to be incomplete because I know that I can find a bigger one. Okay? I don't know, but I imagine that there exists a bigger one. Well, now, from the point of view of this, if a guy who is here, this guy will see a singularity because it sees something, if you want, bad happening from point of view that this you cannot really predict what's happening here. So it's a very hand-waving way of looking at that picture.
Anyone else? In which case, we'll thank Jack again. Finish on time.